This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. Today we talk with the Attorney General about the dismissal of charges and starting Flint water investigations over.
I imagine that the criminal team is going to have to work quickly here.
We'll talk to our political commentators about Governor Whitmer and plans to shut down the high school in Benton Harbor.
When a community loses a high school, particularly a small community, they do lose a basic identity.
We hear from a poet about her Afro-futuristic choreo poem.
It's like having a party, but actually talking about something very serious and political. And that's what I want to do. We're hitting them from all areas.
And we'll hear from our newest artisan of Michigan.
I really try to capture the liquidity of the molten glass in the final piece.
Plus, a book review for Father's Day. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The Attorney General's office dismissed charges against state officials and others in court for actions related to the Flint water crisis. There's been a fair amount of confusion about that action and some anger from some Flint residents directed toward Attorney General Dana Nessel. The Attorney General joins us now. Welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me, Lester.
What was the reason for dismissing these charges?
Well, firstly, it's important to remember that we have a conflict wall in place in our office, and you have some of the office that is representing the state agencies and state defendants and state actors, and then on the other side you have the criminal team that's pursuing criminal cases in regard to any criminal violations that may have occurred. And I'm on the civil side, so everything that I say to you today, I've gleaned from reading press releases, reading transcripts that are available to the public, and listening to court hearings. But I will say this. It was clear, obviously, to the criminal team, including my Solicitor General, Fadwa Hamoud, and Wayne County Prosecutor Kim Worthy, who is a Special Assistant Attorney General on the cases, that there was an exorbitant amount of information that they never received. And that's the reason that they executed a number of search warrants on state agencies, including my office, in order to ensure that they had all the materials that were relevant to what happened involving the turnover of the water in the city of Flint and what the consequences were of that. And so my understanding is there are millions and millions of documents that they obtained that were never previously reviewed, and dozens of electronic devices, cell phones and laptops and desktops, so that they need to review all of that in order to ensure that this process is done correctly and that the right people are properly charged and the wrong people aren't.
So what did you find out about this decision? Did the prosecutors inform you, or did you read it in the newspaper, as you mentioned?
The Solicitor General called me about an hour before they filed the motions to dismiss. They gave me a heads up to let me know that they were going to be filing those.
I wanted to ask you about this trial's been going on for a while. Investigations take a long time. Are you going to be bumping up against statute of limitations issues?
Oh, I imagine that the criminal team is going to have to work quickly here. Most of the pertinent types of criminal offenses I think they'd be looking at have a six-year statute of limitations. So given that the switch to the Flint River occurred in April of 2014, yeah, they're going to have to work quickly. So this is not going to be a lengthy, drawn-out process. They're going to have to move as quickly as possible to review all the new materials they've received.
I want to talk about this confusion that some residents have about this action. Bridge Magazine quotes resident Leanne Walters as saying, dropping the charges and saying you're going to pick them back up is doing nothing but creating more distrust in the system, end quote. What do you say to Flint residents who've been waiting years to see justice in the wake of the Flint water crisis?
Well, I assume that the people who want to see justice want to make certain that every single person who is criminally liable is actually charged, and that for the people who are charged, including those that the cases were just dismissed against, that those cases are as strong as possible when they do proceed to trial. And so I imagine, given the extent of the documents that this team has now received and is yet to review, that it's likely that those cases will only get stronger. So if you're really looking to hold people accountable that you believe are responsible for criminal actions, you want the best and strongest cases that you can possibly bring to trial. And that's what they're going to get after the review of these documents, I believe. Now, I don't know that for a fact. There could be information that exonerates these individuals. But the fact is, this process has to be fair. It has to be comprehensive. It has to be complete. And the only way to know that that occurs is if all of these items of potential evidence have been reviewed and analyzed.
Dana Nissel is the Attorney General of the State of Michigan. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Let's turn now to Wayne State University Professor of Law, Peter Henning. Welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you, Lester.
You heard what the Attorney General just explained. You were a federal prosecutor. What do you think of this move?
Well, they want a do-over, and so they're concerned that there is evidence out there, and Attorney General Nissel mentioned that there may be evidence that exonerates some or even all of the defendants. And this is always a concern for prosecutors that there may be something that has to be turned over to the defense. And if they're not aware of it, they still have that obligation. So I think they're very concerned that they haven't seen everything. And if I'm a prosecutor on this case, I have to have seen everything. So they're going to take a pause here. Now, how long of a pause remains to be seen. If she's talking about millions of records, this could take months, maybe even upwards of a year, at which point it's possible you could lose things to the statute of limitations.
The underlying premise is former Attorney General Bill Schuette's investigation was bungled. That's their word, not mine. It was used by somebody in the office. And there were conflicts of interest. What do you think of those accusations?
Well, you know, on the bungling side, you know, in any investigation of this scope, there may well be stones that were not turned over and didn't get looked at. On the conflict of interest issue, you know, this is a problem for every state attorney general's office, that they have both criminal jurisdiction and they have to defend the state. And so this is a common problem. And as Attorney General Nissel said, they've put a wall in between the criminal and the civil side. But I really think here that there is a real criticism here of Attorney General Schuette and the special counsel, Todd Flood, that they didn't conduct the kind of investigation that should have been conducted, and they may have charged too early without having reviewed all the material that they have to.
Let's talk about this dismissal. The prosecutors who are in charge, they dismissed the charges using a term without prejudice. What does dismissing without prejudice exactly mean?
Well, because this was before a trial ever occurred, there's no double jeopardy issue here. So without prejudice means that they can come back into court and refile the charges. They could refile the same charges, or they could narrow their case. And I suspect they will narrow it down at least a little bit. But the idea here is that by dismissing the charges, they are allowing the defendants at this point to be free, but understanding that charges could be filed again in the future. So this is something at the pretrial phase. Prosecutors have the authority to do this, but as Attorney General Nissel pointed out, they've got to be careful with the statute of limitations, because with a five-year statute of limitations, they're going to be bumping up against it fairly soon, and so they're going to have to be careful if they're going to refile charges to do it quickly.
How common is using this tool, this dismissing charges without prejudice?
It's not unknown, but it doesn't happen very often, especially with a case as high profile as this one that you had. For example, some of the charges, the charge against Nick Lyon, had gone through a preliminary examination, and the judge had said, now the case can go forward. So it's rare that you see a case dismissed after having gone through the preliminary examination, but it does happen. And I really think what the Attorney General's office is most concerned about is that there may be evidence out there that they have to turn over to the defendants. Mm. And if they don't, then that can blow up a conviction.
What would you expect the Attorney General's prosecutors to do next?
Well, I think they're going to go back and rethink the charges, especially the involuntary manslaughter charge. They're going to want to take a hard look at that. That's not going to be an easy case to prove in court, showing that what someone failed to do resulted in a death. And so I think they're going to have to take a hard look at all of these defendants and even the people who've cooperated in the case and say, can we build a case that we can win in court, because the last thing you want to do is charge defendants and then have them acquitted. That sends the message to the people of Flint that we failed.
People want their pound of flesh for the contamination of Flint water. They would undoubtedly want to know how justice is served if no one ends up being charged. What would you tell them if that were the case?
Well, you know, that's a very good point, that, you know, we have now come to expect that the criminal law will be used perhaps first and foremost, and not everything turns out to be a crime. Now, you do have charges here, for example, misconduct in office and failure to fulfill duties. But if we're expecting to see a dramatic criminal case, it's simply not going to happen. These are the charges that were brought were very narrow and, for the most part, fairly technical. And so I'm not sure whether they will be able to put together a winning case. It's certainly a possibility, but they're going to have to look at it and take a really hard look and say, if we charge, can we win? If you can't win, then you probably shouldn't charge.
You know, there's a lot of concern in Lansing that prosecuting a public official in the duties that they're performing could mean that people in the future are going to say, no, I'm not going to take that job. I mean, I expect that there's going to be some kind of problem sometime during my term or during my work with the government. And I don't want to be sued by everybody who comes along. What do you think about that?
It's an interesting question, because it could well have the effect of discouraging people from accepting these high-level positions by saying, look, I just don't want to get dragged into this. You know, with the Flint water crisis, did people anticipate that it was coming? The answer to that, I think, has to be no. They didn't think that there was going to be this issue, but all of a sudden it happened, and now you have any number of defendants who were charged criminally, although they're off the hook for the moment. But, you know, do I want to run that risk for a government salary?
Peter Henning is a former federal prosecutor and currently a professor of law at the Wayne State University Law School. Thanks as always.
Thank you, Lester.
Former Special Prosecutor Todd Flood did not immediately get back to us for comment. Former Attorney General Bill Schuette tweeted yesterday, quote, "We had an experienced, aggressive, and hard-driving team. Everything we did was for the people of Flint," end quote. We'll be back after the break. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The year is 3071. The place, Detroit. The soundtrack, techno. That's the backdrop to the new Afrofuturistic choreo poem, Salt City. It's being performed this weekend at the Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History. And with us now is the show's writer, poet, activist, and five-time Live at the Apollo winner, Jessica Kerr Moore. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Okay. Help me out here. What is an Afrofuturistic choreo poem?
I know. It's a techno choreo poem, which is even more interesting. So choreo poem was coined by Ndezaki Shange. He's one of my mentors. And Aku Kodogo, who's directing, and Marlise Yerby are women who've been in theater for many years and came out of the world of choreo poem, which is poetry with dance. So it's a dance theater piece with written in poetic narrative. And I've added techno because I wanted the soundtrack to be a Detroit soundtrack. And I wanted to celebrate that music genre that is so under the surface, but all over the world.
Yeah,
right?
I when I saw Detroit techno, I thought, oh, she must be from Detroit, because
of course. So this is the music of, we open with Jeff Mills, and Mike Banks' music is there, and Carl Craig's music is there, and so we have the legends there, and then we have new voices like Nick Speed and drummer B and Omari Jazz, and Stacey Howex Hale is there. And so this is the music I grew up on. I grew up listening to Mojo and The Wizard on the radio in Detroit, and it's futuristic. So Afrofuturism, sure, futurism. It's based in 3071. I wanted to tell a story about a brown girl in the future. I wanted to make us talk about things, heavy things like gentrification, which is something we're talking about in cities all over the world, right? But talk about it not in the right now. I wanted to figure out how do we talk about this and see ourselves in the radiant future. And that's what Salt City is. And people ask, like, why Salt? And it's Salt because we, at one point, Detroit had one of the biggest operating salt mines in the country. So, and so I wanted to, it's a mystical, magical fairy tale. And last night was just really, our opening night was just a dream come true, truly. And children were in the audience getting it. And it really, it, you know, people were asking, can you bring kids? And I'm like, yeah, it's for everybody. But the little girls next to me, they said, is Salt going to run past us again? And that's when I knew we made it. I was like, this is what it's about. You know, like, let's create. I wanted to create a new mythology.
Speaking of that, let me just back you up just a little bit. Kind of give us a one or two sentence description of the storyline of Salt City.
Well, Salt City is the story of a young girl who's born inside of a salt mine with a 909 heartbeat. So her heartbeat is the RPM of techno, and she can't contain herself inside the mine. She feels like she can't breathe anymore in the space that she was born. Her father, it's a beautiful father-daughter story, is the head of the salt mine, and she must leave her father and go to find this other sound. She finds a vinyl record, and she travels to 3071. So there's a love story. There's a man that she meets in this electric forest, and she has to figure out how she moves her people forward into the future. She goes to 3071 and can't find her tribe. She can't find her people. She can't find any proof that they ever existed. And so that's what the story is about, is finding that resolve.
I read it was about identity, belonging, social justice, with an eye toward Detroit, it sounds like, because of the gentrification factor. So what's the message you want your audience to get then?
Is that the story is for everyone. And it's definitely not just a Detroit story. It's definitely a global story because these things are happening in Australia and to Indigenous people all over the planet. And so it's a story, I think, that can touch anybody that's from a place that has roots, that has history, that sometimes you don't recognize it anymore. I remember when I went back to Brooklyn after living in New York for some years, and I stood on the corner of Horton Skimmerhorn and didn't recognize my block anymore. And I was like, well, there used to be a store, and there used to be this, and there's all these used to be. And you're trying to reimagine what used to be there. And so while we're developing all over the globe, it's happening in these places where people existed for a long time, just honoring that. So the piece honors what was before, right? And also says, okay, and this is how we make sure that we're a part of the conversation in the future. And it's just aesthetically amazing. Like the little people that were in the audience were encaptured by the media. It's a big multimedia sound and visual piece. And the dancing is incredible. So
what goes into putting a performance like this together?
Oh my God, a work. We workshopped, me and Aku Kadogo workshopped the piece for 4 years at Spelman College. We did a 20-minute iteration, a 40-minute iteration with students at Spelman and Morehouse. So we workshopped it there. Then we brought on Marlise Yerby. We won a grant. First of all, it takes money. So we won the Night Arts grant. Thank you, Night Arts. We won a $50,000 grant. I won the Joyce Award, which matched the grant for $64,000. And so it takes money, and we're over a budget. So we need money to do it. Vision, and it takes a beautiful team. And we have a projectionist that's an amazing projectionist, graphic designer, lighting design. It's a lot of hands. It's a big team. And we have an incredible cast of dancers that were trained dancers and people who have never been on stage before. And to 12 of them, this cast is incredible. They really, I'm in awe of them, and they blew me away. So my words, you know, I mean, they give me all this credit for writing the story, and I appreciate that, but the words have become magic, have transcended words because it's in their bodies. They've embodied this work in such a way. I think it's a theater experience that people haven't experienced, and I think it's good for people who don't necessarily go to traditional theater. We brought the dance floor into the theater. The intermission, people were dancing. I mean, I've never seen anything like it. I had to turn my phone on. I was like, they're dancing at the intermission because we're playing a Stacey Hot Wax mix. We're playing Mike Banks music. So we're, you know, and so it's the, they're clapping in the middle of the show. It's so good. It's like having a party, but actually talking about something very serious and political. And that's what I want to do. We're hitting them from all areas, but it takes a team.
I want to talk about some of your other projects. Let's talk a little bit about Black Women Rock. You founded this
Black
concert
Women
event.
Black Women Rock, yeah.
How was this not a thing long ago?
Yes, 15 years ago, I was a young producer at the National Black Arts Festival, and I'd been in New York for a long time. I was on the black rock scene in New York City. As a poet, I was always just trying to find my space, my voice inside other sounds and get to bigger audiences. So I knew the women who were making this amazing funk rock music, and they weren't getting radio play, and I was producing for the festival, and I was like, I want to do this tribute to Betty Davis, who was married to Miles Davis, who's alive in Pittsburgh, and we're headed her way next week, which is crazy. And I brought in Imani Azurian to Makali and Divinity Rocks, and I showed the film Afropunk, and I created a festival in the honor of Betty Davis, who now, 15 years later, we've coined ourselves as Daughters of Betty, and it's a rock concert weekend where it's about 12 to 15 piece Black Women Rock Orchestra. I bring in 7 to 10 headliners. The one that's coming up is at the Pittsburgh Jazz Festival. We're headlining June 22nd. Nona Hendrix is coming. Kimberly Nicole from The Voice. Nick West, who's, was playing with Prince before he passed away, an amazing bass player. Melissa Vox, who's a Black woman heavy metal artist. Stephanie Christian from Detroit. Idea from Detroit. State, one of the biggest, probably the biggest Black woman rock artist in the country of Canada. So I know that these women's voices are necessary, are hardcore, and we want to tell the story, the real story of how rock and roll was created. And it's truly the blues sped up, and without Black women musicians, rock and roll wouldn't be rock and roll. I mean, people think about rock and roll, you're always thinking about some white guy with long hair banging on a drum. And you ask any real rock and roll, you ask the Stones, who influenced them? So I'm the Detroit rock baby. I grew up listening to Led Zeppelin and Janis Joplin and Jimi Hendrix. I went to all white Catholic schools. I listened to AC/DC and Metallica too. So there's a lot of Black women out here who like know and love rock and roll music and know the roots of this thing. And this is a movement. It's become incredible. So we're taking it home to the Pittsburgh Jazz Festival, June 22nd. We're headlining at the August Wilson Center. Betty Davis lives there. She knows we're coming. She supports this movement. And it's incredible. And I don't know how I'm in the middle of it. I'm just blessed to be around these rockers.
I was going to say, we're glad to be able to get you in Detroit for a little while. Jessica Kerr Moore will be performing the Afrofuturistic Choreo Poem Salt City tonight, Saturday and Sunday at the Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History in Detroit. I'm glad you had a great performance last night.
It was amazing. Tonight, we're there tonight at 8 o'clock. On Friday and Sunday, we have talkbacks. And I really encourage people to bring young people out so they can hear the actors and directors talk about how this story came to life. And so yeah, I'm honored to do it here in Detroit. And we're going to take it to other platforms. And, of course, we'll travel with it, God willing. But this is the moment right here. And I wanted to launch Salt City in Salt City. And so, yeah, thank you so much.
Jessica Kerr Moore, thanks very much. Have a good
one. Thank you. Okay.
We like to hear from you. What stories are you concerned about? What issues do you want to hear more about? Let us know. Find us on Facebook. Search for Michigan Radio. We're also on Twitter at Stateside Radio and at MichiganRadio.org. Just click the link that says Stateside. The Benton Harbor School District has until midnight tonight to come up with a plan to deal with debt and improve student performance. Governor Gretchen Whitmer has urged the school board to shut down the high school. She says that's the best way to save the district. But the people of Benton Harbor are not happy with that plan.
Governor, you can't shut it down because how you going to have a community without a high school? It don't make sense. We going through the same thing other schools going through, if not worse, as you said yourself. So how you trying to pinpoint us and shut us down? It doesn't make sense.
That was LaCorion Travier, a sophomore at Benton Harbor High School. Here to talk about all of this is our Friday political commentators. Ken Sikkema is senior policy fellow with Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican majority leader of the Michigan Senate. Vicki Barnett is a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic state representative. Ken, why has the governor given Benton Harbor School District this deadline?
Well, I think as she pointed out, you've got two huge problems at Benton Harbor. One is sort of an existing debt that is ever growing in terms of their school district. So it's just at this point, it's not financially viable. And just abysmally poor, and I don't just mean poor, but abysmally poor academic performance, and it's got to get fixed. It can't, you know, the existing situation just can't go on the way it is. And so I give her a lot of credit, not just for creating this deadline, but going down into Benton Harbor and explaining her thinking. It took a lot of courage and, you know, kind of a stand-up governor, in my opinion.
Vicki, the people of Benton Harbor do not want their high school closed. They don't think it deserves the interests of the students. This is a majority African-American community. 95% of the votes of the city went to Whitmer in the election. They believe the governor is not listening to them, and they feel betrayed. Is there a disconnect of some kind here?
There is somewhat of a disconnect, but it's not the governor's fault. Benton Harbor and the Benton Harbor community, aside from the school district, were under a financial manager for a long time. The city is growing by leaps and bounds along the water with people who don't live there. There's a new golf course, but these are fly-in and fly-out people who come in for weekend play and aren't really part of the community. The community's been decimated by the loss of jobs for a long time, and that's all part of the legacy that the governor is inheriting under this program to now deal with the students of Benton Harbor and do what is necessary. And so all of this combined with the financial manager really makes people in Benton Harbor feel like they're not being listened to.
Ken, we've seen the state dissolve other school districts. How's that worked out in other cities?
Well, there's a couple situations where it's actually worked out fairly well in some respects and not very well in another respect. For example, in Albion, you had a similar situation a few years ago where the high school was closed. They tried to maintain a K through 8 system, which is what the governor has proposed for Benton Harbor, but eventually, that K through 8 system had to be dissolved because parents thought that, look, if there's no local high school, we might as well send them to that local district, in this case, Marshall, while they're in elementary school. So, you know, it can work, but I will say, on sort of to support kind of the Benton Harbor residents, when a community loses a high school, particularly a small community, they do lose a basic identity. I mean, that's not a small issue.
Vicki, it seems there's a pattern here. Majority African-American cities and school districts are taken over by the state. The people feel they've lost democracy, that they have no voice. Why do we keep seeing this pattern over and over again in Michigan?
Because obviously Proposal A isn't working. The fact that we are underfunding public schools all over the state isn't working. And Benton Harbor and the previous school districts you talked about are the canary in the coal mine that are telling us why we are at the bottom of the 50 states when it comes to educational performance. And so this is a problem the entire legislature must take a look at and address and fix quickly because it's not doing any good for our students. The fact is, in this case, these students in the high school will be parceled out to 8 different high schools. And where we've seen the system work, like in Albion merging with Marshall Schools, this is a different case. There will be a lottery if more kids want to go to a high school than are allowed. In the Albion Marshall case, the kids went in banc to Marshall Schools. So they weren't separated and left to their own devices and parceled out to be bullied in whatever school district they end up in. And so I think that part of this plan really needs work. These kids need to keep their identity. They need to stay together. And the school and the state is not doing them a favor by requiring a maximum amount of students going into each of 8 different high schools. The K through 8 program is not sustainable in the long run, and we've seen that time and time again. So I think the plan is a good start to try to address it, but there are other problems here. And then there's really no plan to deal with extra funding for the schools that take them on for the special needs students of Benton Harbor. So I'm really concerned that we're not doing them a favor by this plan, although by beginning to talk about it, we are beginning to address the underlying problem of student performance.
Ken, I've only got about 30 seconds to ask you this question, but Vicki brings up the point about Proposal A. Does it need an overhaul?
Well, I think it does, but I want to go back. I give the governor credit for taking this issue on. It's a hard issue. It's a tough issue. It's not easy. I think she's basically saying, I'm willing to take some political hits, but at least she's leading, forcing the issue.
Ken Sikkema is a former Republican legislator. Vicki Barnett, a former Democratic legislator. You can hear them most Fridays here on Stateside. Hey, thanks to both of you. Have a great weekend.
You too.
Thanks, Lester.
Still to come, you know, we take glass for granted, but glass is a wonder.
You learn how to kind of have this conversation with the material and sort of seduce it into this thing that you want it to do. But I am just continually fascinated by the fact that it goes from a liquid to a solid, and it's either colorful or clear, and it's really sparkling. It seems like it's alive.
We introduce you to our latest Artisan of Michigan after the break. You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. For almost 3 years now, we've been traveling the state to visit with artisans, the people who make custom things that we use. Today, we visit Epiphany Glass in Pontiac. April Wagner is a glassblower. She has a line of art under her name, but she also makes beautiful and useful things under the Epiphany Glass name. I asked her to describe her work for someone who's never seen it.
Freeform, colorful, contemporary, very sensuous. I really try to capture the liquidity of the molten glass in the final piece. So lots of curves, lots of really simple shapes that sort of build upon each other. That's what I'm passionate about.
Making glass items is ancient. It dates back to 3500 BC. About 1000 BC, Egyptians started making vessels out of glass.
It's amazing to me that, you know, ancient man could figure out a way to manipulate this material, which is hot and you can't touch it with your hands, and just doesn't seem like something very inviting that you would do. And a lot of that hasn't changed at all. We're still using these same processes.
Watching someone with the experience that Wagner has work with molten glass is fascinating. She uses gravity and centrifugal force and air from her lungs and tools to form what she wants.
So you bring to it what it is going to embody, and it certainly has these physical properties that you can't change, so you learn how to work around them or stretch them a little bit. You learn how to kind of have this conversation with the material and sort of seduce it into this thing that you want it to do. But I am just continually fascinated by the fact that it goes from a liquid to a solid, and it's either colorful or clear, and it's really sparkling. It seems like it's alive. It's a material that really speaks to me and how I understand my place in the world, right? Like, I express the things I see and feel through this material.
It all looks effortless, but it doesn't take long to realize that's an illusion. Watching a bright orange lump on the end of what's called a punty rod turn into the shape she wants is amazing to see.
Glass is, I would say, the hardest art form to learn how to do. It's a year before you're making something that you want to make, and at that point, it's a small cup. To learn how hot something is by reading temperature, I have to know the difference between different colors of orange to tell you what the glass is going to do. Or when I'm turning the piece, how quickly it's moving, then I can tell how hot it is or how gravity and centrifugal force are affecting that piece. And learning that dialogue takes a very long time, and I'm consistently and continually improving on those skills, because if there's something new I want to make, there's no manual out there on how to make it. I have to problem solve it start to finish, and it can be heartbreaking when you make this thing. And we just had this experience recently with some very large lights we were trying to make, and got all the way done with the whole process, went to knock it off the punny rod, which is the end of the process before it goes into the annealing oven, and they broke. And they broke continuously, and I still haven't figured out what the issue is. And I know it's something very simple that I need to change to correct it, but I have to go through the whole process to fix that one little problem at the end of the piece.
Wagner says it took her a year and a half to figure out how to make what she calls a tornado decanter. It's a wine decanter that's shaped to swirl the wine as it's poured. It's hard to imagine how it's made. You can see a photo of it on the MichiganRadio.org website, along with several other items. So who buys handcrafted glass items like these?
Everyone. I have a wide variety because over the years, I've been doing this for over 25 years now, and my work keeps getting more and more expensive. So I don't want to lose that customer who's always supported me at that $100 under price point, which is part of the reason that we have the production line that we can, you know, accommodate someone who wants something really nice and handmade, but doesn't have a lot of extra income to purchase it.
While she does sometimes work alone, designing a new piece or fashioning a prototype, Wagner says there's a social component to fashioning glass.
Typically, I make my work with at least one assistant, sometimes up to four or five assistants, and there has to be a synergy between all of us to, you know, make these split-second decisions, because the glass is really unforgiving. You know, one wrong move and you're burnt or it's broke, and there's no going back.
People are fascinated with the idea of working with glass. They even give lessons at Epiphany Glass. It's alluring. But Wagner says if somebody asked her if they should pursue the work.
In all honesty, I tell most young people who come to me and say they want to be an artist, and I say, no, you don't. Right? And if I can talk them out of it that easily, then no, they shouldn't. It's really something that you have to be dedicated to. You have to make a lot of sacrifices. It's not a job. It's a life, right?
But like a lot of artisans, Wagner sees her work as a calling. April Wagner with Epiphany Glass in Pontiac, our latest Artisan of Michigan. Support for arts and culture coverage is supported in part by an award from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. With Father's Day this Sunday, Stateside's book critic Keith Taylor brought us this review of Dean Kuiper's new memoir about spending time with his father and brothers in rural West Michigan. It's called The Deer Camp.
Tolstoy famously wrote that all happy families are like one another. Each unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. The last part of that sentence certainly seems to apply to the West Michigan family Dean Kuipers describes in his new memoir, The Deer Camp. The family is not poverty-stricken. Kuiper's father clearly did well enough financially, and even though he was never generous, the financial difficulties the sons face feel almost chosen. The father has a superficial piety that keeps him away from substance abuse, but seems to allow him infidelities and the psychological, even physical abuse of his children. The distance he creates between himself and his sons seems almost insurmountable. But the happiness, even the joy, that rises out of this book also seems unique. Even in the first half, when their lives seem impossible and almost beyond redemption, Dean Kuipers and his brothers find their own slightly oblique ways to support each other through substance abuse, mental illness, and their inabilities, much like their father's, to form lasting relationships. After all their fights and problems, these four men recognize they have a commitment to each other when they realize they have a similar commitment to a small plot of land many miles north of their homes in Kalamazoo, up closer to Ludington, on the southern edge of the Manistee National Forest. It is there, at the deer camp, where the book finds its heart. It is there that the relationship between the three brothers and their father can begin to heal. The small hunting retreat they buy is 95 acres of scrubby third-growth forest. The land has been over-farmed and abused by chemicals. Large stands of non-native trees have taken root where nothing else will. It is a sandy, windswept place surrounded by swamps and filled with mosquitoes. It is the kind of place anyone who has driven back roads in north central Michigan will recognize in a minute. It is a landscape that many of us, against all reason, have come to love. As Dean and his brothers find ways to reinvigorate the land, the game species they want to hunt, the woodcock, the ruffed grouse, even the white-tailed deer, come back healthy and plentiful. And that isn't all. As Kuipers writes, a new affection flowed out of the sand and trees and grew thick among us. As important and as moving as the family saga is, the author isn't content with leaving it focused simply on them. Throughout the book, he searches for larger answers to the problems that split this family and to the place that seems to have healed them. Near the end, he quotes a Native American educator who points out that the Okanagan word for the human body and its senses translates as land dreaming capacity. I read this, Kuipers writes, and cheered, and it stayed with me forever. She didn't mean dreaming like a story that is born in your mind and seems isolated to your private thoughts. She meant the kind of dream that interprets information flowing in from elsewhere. In this lovely memoir, it is information from a restored piece of land that goes a long way to healing the relationship between a father and his sons.
That was writer Keith Taylor with a review of Dean Kuipers' new memoir, The Deer Camp. The Michigan House of Representatives passed its version of a state budget plan yesterday, along party lines. Zach Gorchow with the Gongor News Service is here with some of the highlights. Let's talk about Democrat Governor Gretchen Whitmer's gas tax hike proposal. The House rejected that, but it came up with a plan to put some money in road repair. What does the Republican majority want to do?
Basically, they are scraping together money from different parts of the budget and rededicating that to roads. This is their way of finding other money for roads without a tax increase. The other big piece is to, in a roundabout way, remove the current sales tax from gasoline purchases. Those are revenues that go to schools and local governments, and instead replace it with a transportation dedicated tax. So depending on the price of gas, that equals about 15 to 18 cents of road funding per gallon, but it's not something people would notice at the pump.
How much money would that total up to for road repair?
$850 million.
Hmm.
And that is well shy of the figure that most people say is needed, that being $2.2 billion more money per year for roads to bring them up into good or fair condition in the coming years.
And as you said, the gasoline tax goes to pay for other things. What will the fallout of that be?
Well, by not using the governor's gasoline tax proposal, that puts more pressure on the rest of the budget. One of the things the governor wanted to do with her proposal with the 45 cent per gallon tax increase was to unwind some of the previous decisions, which was things like using school aid fund money for universities, and instead the general fund would pay for universities as it historically has done. And by doing that, you have more money for K-12 schools. As a result of not doing that, you have much greater pressure on those two budgets. The House proposal is for universities to receive a 0.7% increase in funding, which is obviously pretty small. And their increase for K-12 schools on the surface looks somewhat comparable to the governor's in that they're proposing a $180 per pupil increase for the lowest funded districts, which is also what the governor has proposed. But Their funding increase is not the same because the governor had proposed separate funding for schools with large numbers of at-risk pupils. Those are lower income children from lower income families, for special education students, English language learners, that sort of thing. And so that districts would not be getting the money that the governor's budget would provide them.
There was also this idea floated around about toll roads. Are we talking about turning existing interstates into toll roads or what?
Well, you know, it's a very interesting topic. Historically, the possibility would not have been doable because under federal law and rules, if a state wants to convert an existing free highway into a toll road that was built with federal money, or at least in part with federal money, they have to pay back the federal government everything that the feds put into it, or just simply build the whole thing on their own, which is financially not feasible. However, there is a waiver process in the federal transportation law where three states can obtain waivers from the U.S. highway body to convert an existing free highway to a toll road. Now, it is a cumbersome process. No one has ever done it, but it is possible. Rhode Island also has implemented a toll system for bridges, which is pretty, and only for commercial heavy trucks, which is interesting because it is much more feasible to front the money to rebuild a bridge than an entire interstate. And that has filled a big gap, about 10% of what they needed to pay for bridges. So that's also something that the governor has obliquely hinted she might be looking at down the road. But the thing with toll roads is you're talking about future ideas. This is stuff that would be well down the road. It might make a ton of sense. What if you converted I-94 from the Indiana state line to the Blue Water Bridge to a toll road? That's a major commercial corridor and would relieve the state transportation fund of an enormous burden and maintenance and expansion needs. We're talking something that if you did it, would be years away.
And the big question is, what would business do to fight that? I would imagine that would be quite a bit, even though a lot of these trucks are from out of state. And would car drivers, be subject to tolls as well? I don't know how they deal with all of that.
Well, there's a lot of different ways to do it. And I should say, in Rhode Island, the trucking industry is suing in federal court. So who knows how that would turn out? Probably one of the reasons why the governor is not looking to jump in on that until that's been settled. But, you know, the road interests are interested in at least the state authorizing tolls, maybe, you know, getting permission, you know, at least positioning itself to do something. How the business community would react, I don't know.
The House budget includes the possibility of selling the Blue Water Bridge from Michigan to Canada at Port Huron, selling some rest stops, some airports. Does the budget bank on selling those state assets?
No, and the way the budget's worded, it really doesn't talk about selling them per se. It's more about trying to find out what they're worth, and what they would do with that information, you know, is really not up to the legislature. It's certainly not something they can force on their own. I don't think it's a proposal that anyone is really taking terribly seriously. The idea that the state would in some way divest itself of its half of the Blue Water Bridge.
Understood. Hey, I'm running out of time here. I want to get a couple of things real quickly. What did the Democrats say about the budget as passed in the chamber?
I mean, they're completely opposed to it. I don't think there were either zero or very few Democratic votes for it. They've been putting out statements that it is shortchanging schools, that it's basically a fantasy land approach to roads, and that it does not meet the needs for services that have been hurting for a while to get the funding they need.
How do you think the House version of the budget will be received by the Senate?
Well, you know, they're not wildly different ideas, and the Senate has not really signaled what it's going to do with roads. The House has pretty much put its cards on the table now with this idea of changing up how taxes are applied at the pump. You know, like I said, these are two groups, the House and Senate Republicans, that generally think alike. So I don't think the big difference is there. It's really going to come down to Governor Whitmer and the legislature. How do they try to bridge this gap?
So the state of Michigan's been approving the budget early over the past 8 years. What do you think is going to happen this year?
I've been telling people, have your calendars clear for September 30th, the last day of the fiscal year. I don't think they're going to do something stupid like get into a shutdown as happened in the previous decade, but boy, it could go right to the wire on the 30th.
Zach Gorchow is editor for Gongwer News Service Michigan. Good to talk to you as always.
Thanks, Lester.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank and engineered by Rusty Brock. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend and happy Father's Day.